Tribcast. This is State Senator Jeff Wentworth, who now believes that Winston Churchill had it right when he said, the best argument against democracy is a five-minute conversation with an average voter. And now, here is your host.
Thank you, Senator. This is not Reeve Hamilton, nor is it spare tire guest host Ben Philpott. This is instead Ross Ramsey of the Texas Tribune. We've got with us today Morgan Smith of the Tribune.
Hello.
Jay Root of the Tribune.
Hello.
The Golden Voice. And Jim Henson from the University of Texas at Austin.
Platinum Voice.
Platinum Voice. Well, step it up. Let's start with you because you've been doing this polling stuff. So let me just throw it at you and say, you know, what jumps out of this poll at you?
Well, as of this taping, we're midpoint of the poll release. You know, what jumps out on one hand is that in the electoral races there were, you know, no surprises. We had huge leads enjoyed by Romney in the presidential race and by Ted Cruz in the Senate race. You know, 14, 15 points. Whether the end number is exactly that, it'll be in that range with the Democratic candidates struggling and not quite breaking 40 in the case of Sadler and Obama. Neither of those, again, very surprising. I think when you look at the overall scope of things and think about it as where is the state as we head into the election and we head toward the looming legislative session, there's not been a lot of change beneath the surface here. You know, for all the, it's felt like there's been a lot going on, that the Cruz race and the Republican primary really was, kind of a marquee race in the state. Conservatives still kind of dominating in all these issue areas. They're dominating in their priorities. You look at the most important problems facing Texas item, which we ask every time. The economy and unemployment had challenged our perennial front runners, immigration and border security.
Right, those have slid way down on the national list now, right?
Well,
list of national concerns, rather.
Well, yeah, immigration and border security, interestingly enough, had never registered particularly high on national concerns. That had been dominated by the economy. At the state level, though, border security and immigration have been hard to knock off. The immigration or the economy numbers rose for a while. They seem to be receding as people get, I think, less worried about the effect of the national economy in Texas. People are still worried about the national economy, but it's not affecting their view of Texas very much.
You know, one of the things that jumped out at me about the economic stuff was how pessimistic they are about the future. You know, when you ask them, is the worst behind us or is the worst, is the worst ahead? Texans, was it 42% said the worst is ahead of us?
Right. You and I were talking about this last week, and I think there's a couple of things about this. So there, on one hand, if you look at it head on, it seems like there's a lot of cognitive dissonance going on here, and I think to some degree that's right. So that, you know, the right track, wrong track numbers are actually getting a little bit better, but then we've got that number, a couple of items about the future, and you actually explicitly point people to the future and ask them, do you think your kids are going to be better off than you are? Do you think the economy is going to get better or get worse? And they're negative, even though their more immediate and retrospective assessments are better. Now, I think there's two things there. Look, there is cognitive dissonance here. That is, you know, I think we should be long past the point where we expect people to hold internally consistent views about things, both in terms of, you know, I see Jay, you know, nodding his head. I mean, both in terms of our human experience, but what we know from cognitive science is that, people are great at, you know, harboring contradictions, other than the people at this table, of course.
Right. Even candidates can't do it. You know, we shouldn't expect it of humans, right?
Right. But then the other piece is that, you know, the overall numbers can be a little bit deceptive. You look at the top lines, but the nature of the underlying partisan breakdown and the way that people are very partisan are assessing things through that partisan lens means that you've got really lopsided results within partisan categories, particularly if you look at Democrats, Republicans, and then you've got a lot of very conservative, kind of pessimistic independents in the state, and that tends to affect the readings.
There's
on every
new band name, conservative, independent, pessimist.
Well, you should do that.
There you go.
Guitar, drums,
whatever.
I think that basically, you know, helps make a little bit more sense out of this beyond just the fact that, you know, people are good at harboring contradictions.
Down inside the right track, wrong track numbers, the people that thought the state and the country were on right track and wrong track, you know, that depended on your party line and who was in charge, right?
Right. And I think that's not, you know, a week from a general election in a campaign that's had a lot of negative advertising and in an environment that's very polarized. You know, there's nothing too surprising about that, I don't think.
What was interesting to me, and I think this was in the poll that was in one of the releases earlier this week, was you do see this pessimism about the future, but then when you look at when the question was, are you better off than you were 4 years ago, you had most people saying that they're either about the same or slightly better off.
Yeah, and that was even, and I think that was actually even just 1 year ago.
Or 1 year ago,
right. So, which I think makes your point even more. I mean, you know, people are seeming like in the here and now that things are picking up, but there's a lot of negativity just in the ether right now that's a function of the campaign and a function of partisanship.
Right. I had a bunch of questions that are, I guess, ahead of us as we talk, but will be published by the time you hear this probably. And it's the difference in the way people view the state and federal governments. They're much more, or Texas voters in this thing were much more accepting of Texas government than the federal government. They appear to hate the federal government almost as much as Rick Perry does.
Right. They're suspicious of state government. They're hostile toward the federal government. That's
right.
That's the way I would put it. It's not like they're going around loving Texas government per se, but they're, you know, extremely hostile to the federal government in almost all of these measures, save one interesting one, which is the item that we asked about indirectly about the Voting Rights Act. So we asked an item
that
asked, you know, essentially, you know, there are measures in place to address the consequences of discrimination in the past. Do you think that the federal government should remain involved in the supervision of changes in the voting rights in the voting and election system, or do you think the states should be able to make decisions on their own? And surprisingly, we got a narrow majority of people, I think 51%, saying that the government should remain in a supervisory role over these changes. Now, this was one of those cases where if you drill down and you look at how people responded to this, you know, in a partisan frame, it was very lopsided. So if you just take the ends of the ideological spectrum, you know, the overall results were 51% saying the states should still be under federal supervision, 36% saying the states should be able to now be free to make their own changes. That split goes to 20 in favor of continued federal supervision, 70 against it.
That's
among strong Republicans.
So
not all Republicans, but strong Republicans.
Right.
And then among strong Democrats, it's even more polarized, 84% in favor of continuing what would essentially be Voting Rights Act supervision and 8% opposing it, with independents split 44-37, slightly actually in favor of supervision. So that's really one of the key examples of, you look at, you know, it looks one way when you look at the overall numbers, but the explanation really comes from polarized attitudes and the balance between Republicans and Democrats in the state.
Right. Wait, there was a really interesting question in here, and I think this has been the result for a while in these polls, because we've been asking this question for a while on gay marriages, same-sex marriages, civil unions. If, you know, depends on how you parse this, but I think it was 69 or 70% think that some form of legalized partnership should be allowed, you know, whether they were for marriage or not for marriage, but for civil unions. And 25%, if I'm remembering right, we're against any kind of legalized partnerships. That looks pretty permissive. Were the partisan lines in there too, or?
Yeah, the partisan lines in there were even more pronounced than in the other question, right? So if you look at strong Republicans, although you know, I should say, I mean, that giving people that middle point does tell you something kind of interesting. So strong Republicans, only 9% favored gay marriage. 48% were okay with civil unions. 40% opposed either. Right,
and that's so strong. 57% of strong Republicans were in favor of some kind of legalized.
Right, so about 11, or about, you know, about 20 points, I guess, less than the overall sample. You know, but extreme conservatives, you know, kind of in that same ballpark. You figure those strong Republicans, that category makes up about a quarter of our sample.
Right.
And so, you know, meaning probably a little more than that of the of, you know, likely voters of the actual voting pool. So that's where, you know, that's the bulwark here. I mean, right. The story there is that even though you can see a moderate position in civil unions, the people that are most intensely against it and in the largest numbers are actually fairly cohesive and lodged in Republican primaries. And I think, you know, state legislators know that.
There's just been a quantum shift on that issue, though, and I think it's fascinating. I mean, because I think that probably the children of the very you know, hardcore conservatives have completely different views about this. You know, I know that certainly the way I grew up and the way my kids are growing up with the issue of gay marriage and just, you know, gay rights is completely different. And I think that you're seeing the disappearance of that as a wedge issue. I mean, I think that I was actually talking to a Republican strategist yesterday who was telling me that this is one of those things that you can't really use like you used to be able to use as a wedge issue in a campaign.
Was he crying?
You just have to stay away from it. You know, you have to stay away from it because the ground is shifting, so it's not safe anymore to demagogue or to really go hard on that issue.
This old God's guns and gays thing, that
right?
The bulwark of the Roe Republicans.
To
for
find
a long
another
time
G in there,
right? For,
yeah,
you have to find a new one,
right?
Did you see any other movement in here? I mean, did you see anything else, you know, just sort of across the poll where you thought, you know, attitudes are changing here or attitudes are changing here? It looked like support for voter ID was down a little bit, but it's still very, very strong.
Right.
Two-thirds of Texans still are in favor of some kind of photo ID.
Yeah, I think support for photo ID was down about 8 points from the day that a couple of years ago that Troy Frazier quoted our poll on the floor of the Senate.
Right.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing that brings you a lot of professional satisfaction.
Do you see any other issues sort of on, you know, moving in Texas, or is this kind of?
You know, I really didn't. To me, what's most interesting is what's not moving, and that's education. I think, you know, we've talked about that in here before. I mean, I think, you know, I kind of feel like it's the dog that doesn't bark after.
This is the budget cuts to education?
No, I mean just where it is in the most important problem range, right? And that's what I mean. You know, we have a history. You know, we've seen in polling results that, you know, there's a certain social acceptability here that if you ask people questions about education, more or less out of context and out of priority, you know, very few people are willing to say I'm against it, or I don't want to spend more money on it, or, you know, to hell with the kids. I mean, you're just not going to see people comfortable expressing, you know, that attitude by and large. But when you put it in an array and say, okay, what's the most important problem here facing the country or facing the state? Education is not moving much. It moved a little bit from 6, 7, 8 range into 10, the 10-11 range, but it doesn't seem to be moving.
That's the percentage of people who listed it as the top problem.
That's exactly right. And we're just not seeing it move much beyond that. And again, part of this is partisanship, and that, you know, it's pronouncedly unimportant to Republican respondents in that context, and it's somewhat more important, you know, it ranks much more highly among Democrats, but you're still not seeing the kind of groundswell that some people were predicting in the wake of the budget cuts in last session. That is, I mean, one of the, you know, rallying cries as the ship was going down and, you know, the last people were on it, sort of shaking their fists going, you know, they'll be hell to pay at the ballot box.
Right.
Now, maybe we'll see that in November. What I suspect is there will be hell to pay in a few targeted areas, but we're not seeing this huge groundswell. I don't think parents are beating down the doors of the legislature saying, give us the money back. But Morgan,
I think that you kind of have to separate feelings about education from the funding parts and then some of the other policy sides. I think we have seen a groundswell that lawmakers are responding to, though it's more difficult to see the effects of it at the ballot box, and that is over the accountability system and how we are testing students in public schools. And I think that this was something that was definitely discussed during the last legislative session, and it was brought up in the context of budget cuts. Are we going to keep holding schools to this higher standard as we're taking out all this money? And also the concerns over, you know, how well are we in a position to implement this new accountability system? But it didn't really gain much traction until parents actually saw the effects of it in their classroom, and I think it became very real at that point, where we have not seen the effects of the budget cuts become very real, I think, for the most people, because I think school districts and administrators have all tried very hard to keep the effects away from the classroom, and that's where most people would probably come into contact with them, unless they're a teacher or another school employee that's being laid off.
Well, you've been following Dan Patrick around. What are the legislators hearing out there? I mean, he's the new public education chairman in the Senate, and, you know, has some kind of agenda. He thinks he's hearing something. I'm curious, you know, we know what the polls say, and we know that maybe last session hasn't lit, but we've got all the schools in court over school finance, so there's the finance piece, and Patrick's talking about vouchers and some other things. What does he think the public's after?
That's right. I think, you know, he has tapped into a feeling of, and it's hard, like I said, it's hard to trace that to budget cuts or what have you, but he has tapped into some public feeling of just concern and discontent over what is happening in public schools. And he, I think, has latched on to what it is, what he thinks is the answer, is reforming school choice voucher programs in public education. And I think, you know, he's not talking in a very detailed way about it yet. And I think
that was my next question.
Yeah. I think, you know, when you say school choice, it's just such a very, very broad, it's kind of one of those things that if you ask somebody, you know, do you think that parents should have more options about to send their kids to quality schools, everybody's going to say yes.
Right.
But then when you drill down and say, okay, do you think that parents should get, you know, $5,000 vouchers or 60% of whatever the state spends on their student to educate them in public schools and be able to use that to send their kids to a secular religious private school to homeschool their kids, that's when it starts getting more complicated. But I think Dan Patrick has really latched on to an idea that people are just saying, okay, something is not going right in the public education, in public schools. So we need to do something. But there isn't a coherent way that, there's not a coherence out there that, okay, that means that we need to, start electing more Democrats, or that means we need to put more money, we need to restore the budget cuts in. But it does mean that something has to change, and he's talking about very, very big changes. And, you know, maybe that's something that's going to be appealing to people.
Is he throwing off any sparks about this is going to be a statewide school choice program, or this is going to be a pilot program? Is he any of that kind of detail yet?
He hasn't. That definitely hasn't come out. I think, you know, he's thinking big, though. So I wouldn't imagine.
I'm shocked.
I wouldn't imagine that, especially, you know, whenever he presents the legislation that he's going to carry at the beginning, I wouldn't imagine that he's going to start out saying, okay, we're going to do this in a kind of limited small pilot program. I mean, that might be what through negotiations ends up actually happening if we do have this happen during the session. But, you know, I think he's going to start out pretty big with a pretty broad scope, broad-based planned.
Is he talking much yet about, you know, one of the things that we're hearing in elections around the state and in House races and a couple of Senate races is people talking about the star tests and stuff like that. Is Patrick talking much about that?
He is, actually. I mean, he's following Senator Florence Shapiro, who was just widely known that she was not flexible at all. She was one of the architects of the accountability system that we're transitioning into, and it was just widely known that she was not going to be open to making any kind of changes. And she actually was kind of towed the line with the House during the last legislative session when the House passed modifications and kind of tried to address, I think, some of the concerns that we're now seeing. while Dan Patrick hasn't come out and explicitly said I am different than my predecessor on this issue, he's saying the kinds of things that people say when they know that, to indicate that he's going to be flexible. He says that, you know, I think lawmakers, you know, if there are concerns out there, lawmakers need to be open to revisiting and addressing some of the issues, you know, and admitting that maybe we're not always right. And he is talking about just the importance. He always says that, you know, accountability is very important, and that's, you know, that's what everybody always starts out saying when they talk about this issue. But then he comes around and says, okay, you know, maybe there are issues that we need to address, and I think it is important to be flexible. Accountability with flexibility, I think, is the phrase that he used when I last talked to him.
There's your bumper sticker right there.
I predict this voucher thing, though, is going, right at the end of the session, it's going to be like carrying ice through the jungle, and, you know, you end up with a little tiny cube at the end, and it's going to be a huge thing at the beginning of the session. I mean, you know, Speaker Strauss seems to be very, very cautious and probably a little skeptical about vouchers, and there are a lot of members, you know, it's the same dynamics. I don't think it's going to change that much, where you have a lot of Republicans in districts. You know, the school district is a big deal, where they're
rural,
yeah, right,
rural,
you know,
members from both parties have always been very reluctant to do this.
So I just think that by the time you end up with something, it's really going to be like slicing the loaf until, you know, you don't have much left.
I think that's right, but the other concern is, you know, with Dan Patrick in the chair in the Senate, is he going to, and this being his pet issue, is he going to hold other legislation hostage until he kind of gets what he wants out of the Senate, and then, you know, we don't know what will happen in the House. But I think that's kind of a concern among some people that, okay, we do need to make some changes to assessment or accountability or other education issues that we really need to take up. Mm-hmm. But is the voucher issue, is the school choice issue really going to just suck all the air out of the room? And I think, you know, we'll just have to see how, what Dan Patrick's style is going to be when he starts leading the committee.
I wouldn't be surprised, based on what the governor has said, that, you know, if he makes it an emergency issue and jumps into this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I thought one of the things that was interesting in your story, in terms of these metaphors of the ice and the loaf of bread,
sorry,
was that
get our biscuits out of the jungle.
Here, let me add another metaphor. No, they both give me something to hang my hat on. Holy, wow. This is your mixed metaphor trip.
Allegory purgatory. Here we go.
But what I would say, I mean, one of the interesting things in the profile you did of Patrick over the weekend, Morgan, which was terrific, was, you know, I think spoke to that strategy. I mean, this idea that he's playing, you know, I'm not going to tell you until I tell you. Right. But one of the messages it seemed like he wanted to send through your story, and he's sending more generally, is that I am thinking big. You know, choice means, you know, every choice, not just public-private, not just, you know, religious-secular, but, you know, public schools within districts. And I think that could be part of a strategy to make, you know, a bigger ice cube or a larger loaf, so that when he gets to the end of the baking period or the run through the jungle, he's got a larger slice of bread or a little more ice in his hand.
Something more substantial at the end.
Nice.
Where do you think Perry's going with this stuff? I mean, he's talked about vouchers. He's been big on this. He's been talking a lot lately, and all of a sudden, Rick Perry's back in Texas.
Yeah, he has really. I mean, it seems like I get a media advisory, you know, once or twice a day.
Hey, buddy.
Yeah, no, he's really, really increased his profile on a lot of issues, from, you know, stem cell one day, and then some kind of economic development announcement the next. You know, it seems like it started with the trip to Italy, and it just has been full gas ever since then.
The trip to Italy was F1 racing, and
right.
And red wine.
You know, and he's going out and campaigning for Mitt Romney. A lot of speculation about, you know, is he running for governor? Is he running for president? I think, you know, obviously a lot of it. Yes, is the answer. I think a lot of it depends, obviously, on, you know, who wins the presidential race. But you're starting to see a lot of moving parts kind of coming together. Rick Perry is putting his political team together soon after the election.
let's suppose you were a lawyer and you were sitting in your office in the top floor of the Price Daniel Jr. building over there, acting as the state's attorney general. How do you read all of this?
You know, there are basically three people that we should have our eyes on: Rick Perry, Greg Abbott, and David Dewhurst. And one of them's going to get voted off the island, and I have a feeling it's going to be David Dewhurst. I wouldn't be surprised if, we don't know these things. These are things that happen behind closed doors. But I wouldn't be surprised if you see Perry run for governor, Abbott run for lieutenant governor, and David Dewhurst is not supported by either one of them, obviously.
Riding off into the sunset.
I was really hoping you were going to break into a Charlie Rich impersonation there and start doing behind closed doors. Maybe we can do that at the end.
No one knows what goes on.
Yeah, I knew it would take very little urging to make that happen.
You said the golden voice.
We're not on your back porch.
We blame Jim Henson for this. So you wrote a short story that got a lot of attention this week about Democrats in Lubbock. First, there's Democrats in Lubbock.
Yeah, I know. That was the thing. I mean, it's hard.
And he's a little beat up.
He has a camera.
It's hard to ignore the emails when you see this coming from the Democrats in Lubbock, because it's like all three of them. I mean, you know, it is a pretty tiny party
somewhere
out there.
Somewhere in the sand dune.
But there, it's been sort of interesting because they've had these Obama signs that have been defaced. There were racial slurs written onto them. They were being stolen. And then, a video surfaced. There was a volunteer out there, Hispanic volunteer, was capturing video of some of the sign theft. And there was an altercation. Four or five guys get out of a car. The camera is, they sock the camera and sock him in the mouth, apparently, and shouted some racial slurs at him, told him to go back to Mexico. And so it was very pretty interesting video. And I got a lot of interesting mail about it, and a lot of people who just thought, why are you doing this story? And to me, I thought it was newsworthy when you have the presidential race sort of put into the crosshairs, through this racial lens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what's interesting about this, you hear all these arguments that, people make too much of race. And then, when you cover the story, people are like, well, either that's exceptional or everybody knows people feel that way, so don't cover it. Talk about your ability to either absorb cognitive dissonance or, just completely prevaricate, and lie in the performance of your duty as a consultant. I mean, I think, the negative backlash on that kind of story and the idea that somehow that's not news is ridiculous.
Right, right. Well, this is the last podcast before the election. Anybody want to make crazy predictions?
I think...
I look to Jay for this first.
I think Romney will... This is not a crazy prediction. I think Romney will carry Texas at a higher... That he'll get more than John McCain did, which I think is interesting because you had 4 years and you think, well, the vote should be getting, more. There should be more minorities than there were 4 years ago because that's where the growth is, right? But so what's happened in the meantime? I mean, I think that, maybe the percentage of the white vote going to the Republican maybe is even higher than it was 4 years ago. But I think it's noteworthy that Romney will, I predict, just according to our polls, that we'll do better than McCain did 4 years ago.
Well, I think it's also a matter of just Democrats not being as enthusiastic in turning out this year. Mm-hmm. I mean, just in terms of how they feel about the president and the candidate. It might be that, maybe there's fewer or there's more people voting Republican, but I think it also could just be just an enthusiasm factor.
Well, I think there's enthusiasm among mainline Democratic voters, but I think you're going to see less enthusiasm among younger voters in Texas, and that's going to contribute. And I also think that, Obama's negatives are extremely high here. I think, the idea of Obama in the abstract to some middle-of-the-road Texans that weren't crazy about McCain and the idea of Obama, the reality now, are going to be pretty different. The opposition to the president, we've talked about this in this podcast a bunch of times, in Texas is just really intense. I mean, yeah. It's you know, it's something to behold when you look at the numbers. And I think, you know, that's going to feed this somewhat too.
I'm curious to see who gets the biggest swing. So I heard from some Republican pollsters, you know, this is sort of sketchy, but, you know, heard from some Republican pollsters 10 days ago or so that Wendy Davis was ahead of Mark Shelton in that district, but that Romney was way ahead of Obama in that district. And, you know, I'm curious to see in some of those races how big the swing is from the top of the ticket down to some of these few contested races, you know, the Davis-Shelton race in Tarrant County, the Canseco-Gallego race, the Weber-Lampson race,
right.
some races like that around the state, to see if Texans are as thrilled about Romney as the overall polls look and how they change as they go down the ballot.
Yeah, I think those district races are really, I mean, ground game is going to be really important, is going to tell the tale in those close races. I don't think the top of the ticket is going to save anybody on either side.
All right, on that note, we'll end this thing. If you have comments or questions or suggestions, send them to tribcast@texastribune.org. For Jim Hansen, Morgan Smith, Jay Root, Todd Wiseman, who is running the board, I am not Reeve, not Ben. And I'm Ross Rams.
Yeah, isn't this? Can you imagine Reeve Hamilton calling somebody unpleasant?